Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this special edition of the Nonprofit Coach with Ted Hart, the Green Nonprofit Show. You know going green is the right thing to do for the environment and your organization, but budgets are tight and knowing how to get started can be a mystery. This show provides the practical advice on going green you and your colleagues need. While each week the Nonprofit Coach with Ted Hart Radio Show provides advice on fundraising, board development, and social media, this special edition is all about helping you go green on a nonprofit budget. Ted Hart is without a doubt one of the foremost nonprofit thought leaders. Also a successful author, this show draws from experts around the world and his book, The Nonprofit Guide to Going Green, available on Amazon.com and at greennonprofits.org. Guests on the Nonprofit Coach, The Green Show, are leaders in their field who share tips and trade secrets for nonprofits. Ted lectures around the world, but now he's here for you. Remember, just like our weekly show, this is a live call-in show. Add your voice by calling 347-324-3080. After the show, you can find all our podcasts at tedhart.com. Just click on radio. Don't forget to dial 347-324-3080. Now, welcome the host of the Nonprofit Coach, The Green Show, Ted Hart.
And welcome here to the Nonprofit Coach. It's great to be back here with The Green Show. Of course, going green for your organization is an extremely important topic, and we're in partnership today with greennonprofits.org. So check out greennonprofits.org and make sure that you sign up for their newsletter so that you will be up to date on all the information for that organization. This is Ted Hart, your host for the show. Today we are coming to you live from the national headquarters of the Charities Aid Foundation of America, and today is February 19th, 2013. Those of you who are familiar with the show know that we always start with page one news. As the announcer mentioned, when we get to our page two expert today, you can call in and ask questions at 347-324-3080. You also can join us over in the chat room, and I see a few folks over in the chat room right now, so you can ask questions there, or you can email me at tedhart@tedhart.com. You can follow along in the radio links by going to tedhart.com, click on radio links, and you will find great resources highlighted for you right there, and you can follow along with not only the links from today's show, but all of the links for all of the Nonprofit Coach radio shows going all the way back to the archives of 2012 and 2011. First up here on the Nonprofit Coach and the radio links, you will find coming to us from the LinkedIn blog, Meg Garlinghouse has posted information on LinkedIn Board Connect, and this is all about helping nonprofits find board members on LinkedIn. Terrific new service. You want to read all about the background information where they're introducing this new service, but also outlining to you the benefits of serving on a nonprofit board and how you can either get involved with a board or find that next terrific new board member. And that link is available in the radio links today here on the Nonprofit Coach, The Green Show. Next up here on the Nonprofit Coach is bringing a good friend of ours back here to the show. Of course, we're just coming back from holiday hiatus. This is our second show of 2013. And part of the tradition of this show is our partnership with the Association of Fundraising Professionals and John Wiley and Sons, known as the AFP Wiley Radio Show. That show will take place each and every month here on the Nonprofit Coach, as it has it did last year as well. And Susan McDermott is with us here live from Wiley to announce who will be our guest next week on the AFP Wiley Radio Show.
Hi, Ted. How are you?
Welcome back here to the Nonprofit Coach.
Hi. Thank you so much, as always, for having me. And I'm eager to tell your audience the author of the and the book that you'll be discussing next week.
I hope you are well rested, since we've had a few weeks off since our last time here together. And I will just let our readers know that over in the radio links today, we have provided them a direct link to the entire AFP Fund Development Series, of which you draw from. So, Susan, drum roll, who will be our top speaker for next week?
Oh, your next speaker is Michael J. Rosen, who is the author of Donor-Centered Plan Gift Marketing, part of the AFP Fund Development Series, as you've mentioned. And basically, the book helps nonprofit organizations move beyond traditional marketing techniques that have historically yielded only modest results and reveals how putting the focus on the donor can produce the best outcomes for all. And a great thing about this book is Michael and the book were the recipients. They were the winners of the Skystone Partners Research Prize. So
that's a very prestigious prize. Please
absolutely.
Tell our listeners a little bit about that, and that's no cakewalk to learn that to win that prize.
No, absolutely not. I mean, there's a committee, and many books were nominated for the prize, and he was selected as the winner. And I was so happy for him. It's a great book. It's almost 350 pages, and really great marketing effort by Michael to get the word out about his book, and he continues to talk about it. And I know he's so eager to talk to your audience next week and share what he's learned.
Well, we're eager to have him here on the show, and because we're just coming back from the holiday hiatus, and this is the first time you and I have had an opportunity to talk about the AFP Fund Development Series and the AFP Wiley Radio Show here on the Nonprofit Coach. The Association of Fundraising Professionals represents over 26,000 members in more than 170 chapters. Having your book chosen to be part of the AFP Fund Development Series is quite an honor. How did Michael's book and others, and throughout the year you'll be bringing us some of the top experts in the nonprofit field through the promotion of these books, how does one get involved?
Well, the first step is to go visit the AFP site, and thank you very much for linking to it from your webpage, but visiting afpnet.org and the proposal guidelines, I guess the first step would be to submit a proposal, and the proposal guidelines are there on the site for anybody to download and fill out with their ideas and submit it to the committee. We meet 3 to 4 times a year, usually via a conference call, but once a year in person at the annual conference, which is coming up in April, as you know, in April in San Diego. So we'll be meeting face-to-face, and the committee is comprised of an international team of fundraisers. There's about 15 of us, and we review the proposals and talk about the literature and the body of literature that's out there for fundraisers and what might be missing, what things are happening, and what new topics we can add to our list of interest. So it's a great committee. I've been involved with them for 12 years, my 12 years at Wiley, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, we certainly appreciate your partnership with this show and the careful, thoughtful work that your committee does in providing a balanced educational opportunity through the AFP Fund Development Series. And we certainly hope that we help bring these books alive through the AFP Wiley Radio Show and bringing some of the top authors and top thinkers in the fundraising and philanthropy sector to the radio show. So Susan McDermott from John Wiley & Sons, thank you for coming on and introducing us to 2013 and the AFP Wiley Radio Series. And next week we'll be kicking that off.
Thank you so much, Ted. It's my pleasure to be here as always.
Talk to you next month.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye now. Back here on page one, I want to draw your attention to a link to the top 10 nonprofit coach episodes of all time. You'll be able to read through and see these are the highest rated shows of all time here on the Nonprofit Coach, and we are fast approaching 3 years on the internet for our live show and podcast. And what's really interesting to me as you read through the top 10 is last year was absolutely explosive here on the Nonprofit Coach, tripled the audience listenership here on the Nonprofit Coach, and every single one of the shows in the top 10 list of all time are from 2012. So thank you to all of our guests throughout 2012, and in particular those who made the top 10 list. And please read through because you'll see some of the brightest stars in the nonprofit sector. A little bit of a gift, I think, maybe for our listeners today. If you've been listening to the Nonprofit Coach, The Green Show, for a while, you'll know what a fan I am of the original Lorax movie and the Lorax book by Dr. Seuss. And today in the Radio Links, we are providing you with an e-book of the original Lorax a book by Dr. Seuss. So if you're a fan, as I am, and you haven't brushed up on your original Lorax, have a listen, have a read. The e-book is now available over at tedhart.com. Click on Radio Links, and you'll find the great links there. It's my pleasure now to introduce you to a gentleman who has been working very, very hard in the green nonprofit sector. Today, John Litzelschwab is here with us. He is a professor emeritus of physics at Dickinson College. He also taught an environmental science course for 4 years and helped form an environmental science department at Dickinson College. His interest in energy conservation dates all the way back to the energy crisis of the 1970s, and he authored a book in 1980 called Household Energy Use and Conservation. He retired in 2003, but certainly did not give up his passion and his love of the environment. He moved to the Menno Haven retirement community and helped initiate the formation of a green team in 2010. But that wasn't enough for John, and we're honoring him today, and we're quite honored to have him come and share his message of why he then sought to inspire the residents of Menno Haven to become a certified green nonprofit. Certified green nonprofit by greennonprofits.org. You can go to that website to learn all about the process for becoming a certified green nonprofit. But right now, today, we have John Litzelschwab with us, who has been through that process. Congratulations, Mr. Litzelschwab.
Thank you.
Now, that's there's a good body of work that you have to go through to become a certified green nonprofit. You must earn 100 points in each of the various categories. Some are required. And while it's not maybe the most difficult thing you'll do in your life, it is perhaps a very satisfying thing to know that an organization has completed a body of work that's meaningful for the environment. So help for our listeners today, who probably because they're listening to The Green Show today already know that the environment is important. But why do you think becoming certified is an important public statement?
Well, I think it says something about the institution that we're here, that we care about the environment, that we're not just doing our things as usual. And on top of that, I think what also helped me convince others is that it saves us money. I think everything we've done so far, we've saved money.
And well, say that again, because, of course, the economy continues to be difficult for a lot of nonprofits. And moving in the process of becoming a green nonprofit and learning how to go green and making substantive changes within your organization can feel like an awful lot of work and maybe just a whole lot of cost. But you're saying there's a bottom line savings for the organization. That's got to be good news.
Yeah, it's when we first got into recycling, we weren't recycling paper, and when we started doing that, it turns out that, of course, we pay so much per ton for trash, and we're saving that money for the recycle. We also found out that because people recycled, they didn't have as much trash to pick up, so when the grounds crew would pick up the weekly trash, or actually they were doing biweekly, could now change to a weekly schedule, and that saved on gas and so forth. So there are lots of benefits you don't realize that come out of this when you go green.
And, of course, those are long-term benefits because cutting down on the use of products and cutting down on the cost of transportation and products of that sort are cumulative over time. They're not just one-time savings.
Right, right. It's you know, over time. We're having an energy audit done. We were going to do this anyway. The company that's doing it shows that if you do this and that and that, and how much you're going to save in 10 years. And there's large amounts of money in there involved in that. So
Now, how was your interaction with green nonprofits? I know that you worked very closely with Diane Peach throughout the process. Did you feel supported, and was this something that was very difficult for you to accomplish, or give us a sense of how the process was for you?
The process was very nice. The problem with the program right now for large institutions is that there are a lot of things that don't mesh up with what we can and can't do. I think the measures are designed for small office situations. For example, buying shade-grown coffee. Now, if we try to do that for this institution, it costs thousands of dollars more because we have a lot of coffee. It's not just like a brew a pot a day or so forth. But on the other hand, of course, things like buying things in bulk, which we do normally, we were able to satisfy that easily.
There's a balance. There's some things that for larger organizations create a bigger bottom line, whereas there are some aspects of the review process that might be more suited for smaller organizations.
Yeah. And there are also things which, if had guidelines for large institutions, that certain things would be more important, like recycle. That's a huge part of going green in a large institution. We worked with Diane and very nicely, and we turned in what we had done, and they agreed with that we had made the effort. So that was great.
I'm very impressed with the extra effort that you put into helping an organization of your size become a certified green nonprofit. Again, congratulations on that. What tips or suggestions do you have for our listeners today who might be thinking of starting the process and maybe it just seems a little overwhelming?
Well, it took a lot of meetings, and we sort of go through them slowly. When you have 100 and some measures, which you try to, or maybe 75 or 80 measures, and you try to satisfy 50 of them, just go through very slowly, take a good look at what you are doing right now, and if you don't feel it's adequate to satisfy that requirement, say, well, what can we do now to satisfy it? Sometimes it's just doing a little extra, and other times you say, well, I just can't do it. So
right.
it's a
and not all of
the
suggestions in that are required, right? There are
some
that are required, and then others that you're able to find those things that are possible for your own particular situation.
Right. And there are some just aren't applicable. There was one that put stickers on light switches to tell people to turn off lights. Well, it turns out in the nursing center you have to sanitize those things every day. So that just wouldn't work. So you have to work around what will work for your institution and what won't.
What is possible. Yeah, it's not meant to be an onerous process, but one that demonstrates a body of work that does ultimately make a difference. And having so many nonprofits come together and become certified adds up to good news for the environment. John Litzelswab, thank you so much for joining us today on The Nonprofit Coach. We really appreciate the hard work that you put into becoming a certified green nonprofit. And please share our good wishes with everyone back at Menno Haven.
Will do. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's John Litzelswab, who headed up the committee over at his retirement community, and they were successful in becoming a green nonprofit, certified green nonprofit. So please go to greennonprofits.org, click on certification. You can start the process. There's no charge at all to start the process and utilize the online tools to help you determine what are those things that you've already done. Now, you may have already earned several points. The experience is that most nonprofits that are thinking of becoming certified have already earned as much as half the points that they need to become certified, but as Mr. Litzelswab just mentioned, there are then those issues that you're going to prioritize and what changes are possible for your particular type of organization. Virtually no two organizations become certified in exactly the same way, and that's why there are options for the certification process, because each organization is unique in their own way. So back here on page one news, just to remind you that you can follow along with the all of the links here on the Nonprofit Coach by going to tedhart.com and click on Radio Links. And with that, it's now time for us to head over to our Page 2 expert. It is my pleasure to welcome back here to the Nonprofit Coach, The Green Show, Barbara Wiseman. Barbara is with the Lawrence Anthony Earth Organization, LAEO, and she is the international president. Over the past 30 years, Barbara has worked with a variety of international organizations, from helping displaced refugees from nations as diverse as China, Iran, Iraq, Vietnam, and Laos to resettle in their new American homes, to introducing effective management principles to business and government leaders in Russia and Mexico. In 2003, Lawrence Anthony, a world-renowned conservationist, invited her to help him create the Lawrence Anthony Earth Organization, an international nonprofit dedicated to investigating and sorting out truth from fiction in environmental issues, and then introducing workable solutions for real problems that face us in these areas. As international president, she has spearheaded the LAEO organization's U.S. activities, including a campaign to clean up the toxic environment in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, the creation of environmental workshops for school children, and the creation of spectacular educational eco safaris in South Africa. So needless to say, no moss grows on Barbara Wiseman. She is a very, very busy person who is out there fighting on behalf of the environment all over the world. And welcome here again to the Nonprofit Coach, The Green Show, Barbara Wiseman.
Hi, Ted. Thanks very much for having me back.
Well, Barbara, it's we just didn't feel that we had quite enough last time that we chatted, because there's so much that's going on with your organization. Now, I want to start off with making sure that, from your own words, you have an opportunity to help our listeners today understand what is the Lawrence Anthony Earth Organization. And I know that in the past you've sort of been referred to as the Earth Organization, but in sort of a rebranding, you want to make sure that everyone is recognizing that Lawrence Anthony is where it started, and Lawrence Anthony is a big part of the branding of your organization. Help us understand all that.
Sure. Lawrence was a world-renowned conservationist. He was had a couple of things that he was, three things actually, was very well known for. One was his extraordinary, almost mythological relationship with a herd of wild elephants that he had rescued and that lived on his private game reserve in South Africa. And his, you know, it became a worldwide, you know, sensation, media sensation, that CNN and BBC and NBC, a lot of different media organizations went down there because nobody could believe that somebody could have this kind of relationship with a herd of wild elephants. And, you know, literally every time he would go away from the reserve, the night that he would return, the whole herd would always magically show up at his house to see him. And unfortunately, he passed away in March of last year, and he was 300 miles away in Johannesburg, and the night that he died, the herd walked 12 miles to his house and stayed there for a few hours in mourning.
So oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
What an interesting story, and that really had not been experienced before?
No, not like that. And that was it was actually immortalized in a book, not obviously his passing, but he wrote a book about this, the relationship that he had with him. He had been dubbed by the media the Elephant Whisperer. And so he wrote a book, and his publisher insisted that the title of it be The Elephant Whisperer. But it's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. You can get it on Amazon.com. And it's the story of how this relationship between him and the elephants developed, and it is a remarkable story. But additionally, he's the man who went into Baghdad at the very beginning of the war, completely on his own in 2003, and rescued the staff and the animals of the Baghdad Zoo. He was there for 5.5 months, and that was also a very large media story, and continues to be, and a book was written about that called Babylon's Ark. The third thing that he was extremely well known for is that he actually got a war stopped in the Congo. It was the longest running war in civil war in the world between the Lord's Resistance Army and the Ugandan government. And for 2 years, he was actually able to get that war stopped. And that is a third book, actually, called The Last Rhinos, because he was going into to rescue the last of the species of rhino and found that the, you know, the source of the demise was this ongoing war. So he managed to get the war stopped, and it's really just an absolutely extraordinary person. So when Lawrence and I started this organization in late 2003, we named it the Earth Organization, but after he passed away last year, we decided that we wanted to make sure people understood that we really were going to continue the goals and purposes that he had envisioned for the group, and so we added his name to the organization and made it the Lawrence Anthony Earth Organization.
Well, it's a wonderful tribute, of course. Help us understand with that that amazing history of the man that bears the name of the organization. What is the future for your organization? What are the goals that you think the next several years will define the Lawrence Anthony Earth Organization?
Well, we currently have about we have 23 chapters in 21 countries, and so yeah, I expect that will our expansion will continue, you know, and grow exponentially. Our local our chapters, our smaller local chapters, take on very specific environmental issues that are important to their area and address those. The U.S. headquarters and the international headquarters in South Africa are taking on global campaigns. And one of the things that I'm most interested in worldwide is the subject of oil spill cleanup around the world. This is a huge issue that a lot of people really don't realize what an enormous issue it is and how badly it's impacting the waters of the world.
The EPA has issued several statements regarding that topic, and your organization, in about 10 days' time, will be releasing a paper that's going to say what?
Well, let me give you a little background on this so that you understand the importance of this paper. For 3 years now, since the beginning of the BP blowout in the Gulf of Mexico, the first thing that we had to do, I was familiar with a methodology called bioremediation, which probably a number of your listeners are familiar with. And basically, it means utilizing Mother Nature to clean up toxic sites. Mother Nature will, in her own good time, eventually clean up the toxic site if left to her own devices. But because of the toxicity, it may take a lot longer than what would be optimum. And therefore then be, you know, dangerous to the environment, to the wildlife, to humans, et cetera. So you, in cleaning up any kind of a toxic site, you're doing that because you want to, you know, make it possible for living organisms to survive, from the smallest microbes up to the largest. But there is a technology called bioremediation, which utilizes natural occurring microbes to clean up toxic sites and to speed that process up enormously. And some of those products work in certain types of situations and don't work well in others. There's a wide variety of products out there. We found, I knew that this technology existed. So when the BP oil spill happened, I watched to see what were they going to use to clean up the waters, and thinking, of course, that they would find the least destructive, most effective solution possible, and was appalled to find that they utilized the worst possible, most toxic, most expensive, least effective product, and that was highly, highly destructive, extremely dangerous to the public's health, tremendously destructive to the fisheries, to the quality of the water, to beachgoers, to the seafood eaters. I mean, it was really, really a bad solution, and I put solution in quotes.
And why would they make a decision of that sort? Was there research out there suggesting to them that that was the correct approach, or just didn't know better, and this is what you're trying to help draw attention to make sure that when these sorts of things happen, there is a body of knowledge that can be turned to understand the best way for the environment to heal itself?
Well, that's a great question. You know, it really took us some serious research to uncover what was going on, but we did. And one of the key things that we found was that when a spill happens, decision makers turn to protocols that are contained in guidance documents that are put out by the EPA. And when we researched those documents, we found that they were antiquated, they were misleading in parts, and some of the very key points were absolutely inaccurate. And the result of that was that anyone reading them would be mistakenly turned off to non-toxic methods and specifically guided towards using that one product, effectively creating a monopoly for that one product. And so in the process...
So is this an issue of successful marketing on the part of a big business that hurts the economy or the environment, or is this just bad research that was outdated that was used inappropriately?
Your first is exactly what was going on. Yeah,
it's interesting because would clearly show that the product was a disaster for the environment because one monopoly was able to make money, they were willing to sell out the environment?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and it's interesting because it's known how destructive this product is, and it was actually used, or a version of it was used on the Exxon Valdez. And it is one of the reasons why, you know, you can still, why the fisheries have completely collapsed. You know, there was a thriving, abundant herring fishery system there with three very large processing plants. And they're closed now, and the herring fishing industry is there because of the use of this extremely toxic product. And that toxic product killed off the microbes in such a way, the natural occurring microbes, in such a way that it slowed down. As slow as the oil cleanup would have been by Mother Nature, it is now even slower because they use that product. The one thing that product does do, and why some would like it, is that when an oil company or someone has a large oil spill, there's a fine to pay to the EPA, which is between $1,000 and $4,000 per gallon spilled. So if you can sink the oil beneath the surface so that you can't see it, it's harder to quantify the oil, and therefore you can negotiate the size of your fines. So you'll find that it has been the norm to sink the oil as quickly as possible. And, quite frankly, the EPA has been in collusion with that because they've allowed that. Not to get into any kind of conspiracy theory, appearance or anything at this, I mean, it's very likely that just... And, you know, some of the incorrect information has been taken at face value because it appeared to be coming from authorities rather than people really looking for themselves.
And right, and I suppose the future will bear that story out because wanting to, you know, be as open-minded to the topic and personally not being someone who is necessarily drawn to conspiracy theories. I suppose that now that you're going to be putting this information out, it's going to be freely available for correct decisions to be made in the future. The story will be told by, you know, our environmentally sound and scientifically sound practices now followed because the information is readily available, or because of some of these maybe nefarious benefits that come from using bad approaches to clean up, if those continue to be the processes, then I suppose you know why it was done.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's interesting. You know, there is a in the Code of Federal Regulations, CFR 40, there is a guideline called the National Contingency Plan for Oil Spill Cleanup, and in those guidelines is a product schedule, and it costs a lot of money to go through the testing necessary to become a product on that product schedule. It's called the NCP list for short, but it doesn't matter how great your product is. If you're not on that list, then when an oil spill in U.S. navigable waters happens, you can't even be considered by law. You can't be considered to be used. So you have to be on that list. But out of the 200 products that have come and gone on that list in the last 25 years, when an oil spill happens, there's only one product that the EPA has ever approved, and it's this one very, very toxic product. So
right.
That
you can't really, I suppose, can't really blame businesses for wanting to rely on products that are approved for, you know, to protect themselves perhaps from legal considerations. But the issue that you're raising is this outdated, antiquated information that is timely to be updated from the EPA. Hopefully you're putting some energy behind that. We're going to take a quick break. Barbara Wiseman, the international president of the Lawrence Anthony Earth Organization, is with us live here on the Nonprofit Coach, The Green Show. And Barbara, when we come back, I want to take all this wonderful information in terms of process and focus on the environment and bring it full circle back for nonprofit organizations in terms of the messages that they should learn from all of this in terms of preparing to be more environmentally sensitive and preparing their organizations hopefully to become a certified green nonprofit. So if we can bring all that back, we're just going to take a really quick break here on the Nonprofit Coach.
Okay, great, Ted.
I just want to point out here on the Nonprofit Coach, get your calendars out just to remind you of the shows that are coming up here on the Nonprofit Coach. As Susan McDermott pointed out, we will next week here on February 26th, we will have the AFP Wiley radio show with Michael Rosen here with his terrific new award-winning book, Donor-Centered Planned Giving. Of course, that's an important topic for all nonprofits who are serious about raising money. And then here on March 5th, Amy Eisenstein will be with us to help you prepare for 2013 and raising more money with less. And then I'm very excited about this, and I hope that you will plan on joining us for March 12th. This is going to be our big third anniversary show here on the Nonprofit Coach, and the lineup of experts throughout the nonprofit sector who are going to be calling in and celebrating with us on the third anniversary show is really quite heartwarming. And as I shared with you earlier, the show has tripled its audience. We are now the largest, most listened to show in the nonprofit fundraising sector, and I'm very, very excited about that. So I hope you've got those dates and those terrific speakers on your calendar, and you'll plan and joining us here on the Nonprofit Coach.
Remember, our podcasts and archives are always available 24 hours a day at tedhart.com. Click on Radio Links. If you're listening live today, the phone lines are open. Call in and ask a question by dialing 347-324-3080. Now, back to the Nonprofit Coach with Ted Hart.
And we're live here on the Nonprofit Coach, The Green Show, with Barbara Wiseman from the Lawrence Anthony Earth Organization. Barbara, bring this wonderful wealth of information that you have learned and that your organization provides around the globe and help our listeners today who are either struggling with becoming more green, trying to decide how do they make the case for becoming more green and potentially becoming a certified green nonprofit. What message do you have for those listeners?
You know, Ted, I think there's a how I'd like to approach that today is to discuss the importance of actually doing enough research before one takes on any project to make sure that you're actually handling, when you start, when you do your project, that you're actually handling the source of the problem so that you're going to get the result that you want of whatever the decaying situation was, for example, that you're trying to take on, actually reverses and heads in the direction that you want it to go. It's, you know, I too often see organizations or people listening to the media, for example, and getting and not doing, you know, just basing their information just on media and not actually looking for themselves. There's an interesting in the industry of public relations. There's an interesting datum that is known, which is that when a person hears the same quote unquote fact or, you know, data from three seemingly, you know, separate sources, they begin to think that, oh, well, this must be true because I heard it from this person and I heard it from that organization and I heard it from, you know, that government, official. And so it is a technology, actually, in doing public relations to plant information in a variety of different places so that people are hearing it from different sources, and then suddenly it becomes the truth, whether it is or not. And it's so important, you know, it's so important to be, if you're handling a situation, to really be handling the source of the problem. I think I talked about this on the last time I was on, and excuse me if I repeat myself, but
but it's good to repeat yourself because these are important messages.
Yeah. And I think this is a great analogy because people can quickly get it, that if you're on the Titanic and you've hit the iceberg, there are so many things that you can do on that ship that will, quote, make it better. But, you know, so you can do things like you can yell at the captain and threaten to sue him. You can, you know, fix the engine. You can get people back on board that fell overboard. You can rearrange the deck chairs and make them more aesthetically pleasing. You can create a beautiful new menu for the passengers. You know, there are all these different things that you can do on that ship that will supposedly make it better. But if you're not handling the hole in the hull, it's all the rest of it is for naught. The ship's going down. And I used to be, before Lawrence asked me to help him start this organization, I was the executive director of a good-sized management consulting firm, and we applied that principle whenever we went in to help a company, and we would look at what was their ideal scene if everything was going perfectly, and then we would look at what's the existing scene, and really look at the statistics, look at the staff, look at what was going on, you know, look at the all departments within it. Really look, not just listen to what people are saying, but look. And we would invariably find things that, you know, were very often really obvious when you looked, but nobody else had looked. And we would find what the true source of that company, what was holding that company down and preventing it from moving forward. And if they spent their resources on fixing the sales department or enhancing the sales department, when the real problem was in their treasury department, for example, then the company would continue to decay and have the problems that they were having. But if you fixed the real source of the problem, the actual hole in the hull, then you've utilized your resources to really turn around the decaying situation and move the whole scene one step closer to eventually getting towards the ideal scene. And when you do that, it gives you more resources, it gives you more time. If you could actually handle that hole in the hull, in my analogy on the Titanic, for example, you know, now you've got time to, feed the people, get them warmed up, get the engine fixed so you can get moving again, and each one of these steps becomes the next most important step to handle so that you can eventually you know, move that scene to an ideal scene. But if you're, sometimes people think, oh, well, you know, maybe this isn't the biggest problem here or the cause of it, but if we work on this, at least it will help it. Well, it's not necessarily true. You know, if you look at what's happening, for instance, in the Gulf of Mexico, the hole in the hole there is the contaminated waters, and yet there is an enormous amount of money that BP is paying into these restoration projects, and we are the only group that's talking about you've got to get the water cleaned up. There are non-toxic, effective solutions for doing that. And what's being talked about is we need to build some new docks, we need to build some new, you know, new barrier islands, none of which does anything to clean the contaminated waters. And without cleaning those contaminated waters, the fishing industry is going to continue to collapse. People are going to continue to be ill. It's going to continue to be dangerous to be eating seafood from the Gulf. I know that's not a popular viewpoint, and I hate saying it.
But for nonprofit organizations, is this an issue of setting appropriate priorities and understanding your options as you move in the direction of becoming green? In other words, you know, there's lots of things that you can do, and if you go to greennonprofits.org and you start the green certification process, you earn 100 points, which are 50 actions that you take. Some are required, but many are optional, and they're about setting priorities for your organization. So is your message a message of you know, go forth, but deal with your priorities first so that you have more time to work on other projects?
Exactly. And you know, in this certification process, for example, doing the research necessary to really see, you know, what are the things that if we put our resources towards doing that, towards changing that or enhancing that, that are going to make the biggest impact in, you know, in achieving our goal in this. And because a lot of time and effort and finances can be chewed up in doing maybe some small things that might be nice and might give you a feeling of, well, gee, we did something. But the what I'm recommending here is sit down and really figure out what's your goal for, you know, for this program of getting certified. And, you know, it's a wonderful project to work on. It's an important project.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, obviously you have a global perspective. So this notion of nonprofits becoming certified and completing a body of work, that can be cumulative if lots of charities choose to publicly show their support for the environment in this way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But
you had an opportunity, I think, earlier you were listening to John Litzelswab, who was with us as one of the newest certified green nonprofits, and he was talking about the very practical nature of that can come from this. So this is not just theory. This is real life. You can make these changes, and he was saying that can also affect positively the bottom line of your organization.
Yes, that was very interesting to me. I was fascinated to hear that.
There's a lot of work that your organization has put into caring for the environment and animals and thinking proactively. What do you think in terms of the footprint of the nonprofit sector, which is so large in the United States, but even larger around the world, as a sector that really should put a focus on what their impact on the environment is?
Well, you're right. The whole nonprofit environmental sector and just nonprofits, as a whole, it's an enormous industry, if you will. And so if that industry, which would tend generally to be more aware of the importance of going green and conserving resources, and if that industry really takes it on to each one and individually become more responsible in their own actions, that's definitely going to have an impact, no question about it. No question about it.
Well, that's the thought behind the greennonprofits.org organization. It's a small organization with a big message, and that is, as you were saying, you know, nonprofit organizations, not universally, but as a group, tend to be a little bit more environmentally sensitive, or at least interested in being good community-centered organizations. And this is one way that a body of work can be completed and displayed to the community, where concrete steps and changes have been made. And that while for one organization that may not be, you know, earth-shattering for the environment, cumulatively, when you're talking about millions of charitable organizations around the world, it really could be quite a different footprint for the world.
It's true, and, you know, it can never be understated the importance of setting a good example for others. Even though maybe, you know, just, you know, your organization recycling your paper and recycling your plastics and that sort of thing, you know, may not make, you know, change the course of what's happening in your city as far as the you know, pollution, but it contributes to it. And but setting that example as well can have an enormous ripple effect outwards.
And of course, one of the other benefits that that the Green Nonprofit Organization hopes to have an influence on is, of course, if we're able to, and I know you've been extremely supportive, so thank you for the energy that you've put behind this Green Nonprofits movement, that if we can make inroads into getting the nonprofits themselves to be certified and be seen as green, to see themselves as green, well, each and every one of those organizations have boards of directors, and each of those boards of directors are often, you know, from corporations or from their communities. And therefore, it's a way that maybe is a little bit less threatening for those folks to be able to become knowledgeable of these topics. That hopefully, and maybe it's a pipe dream, but hopefully that comes back full circle to those corporations and to those communities to say, you know, this may be something that we need to rethink, and that we ourselves may need to make some changes to become more environmentally sensitive ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely, makes total sense.
So it's hopefully a nice circle, but we'll take time. And of course, the important work of an organization like yours. That would you view your organization as a conservation organization or an environmental organization? How do you define yourself?
Really, really both. You know, both environmental and conservation. You know, we're looking at this from a viewpoint that's way above the playing field, if you will, you know, and looking at really the plant and animal kingdoms, as well as the physical universe, just this planet and the health of the planet, and the, you know, looking at it in a very holistic manner, and you know, the symbiotic relationship between all life. Our tagline is "Because none survive alone." And so when you're looking at solving a situation, you really have to look at all the different aspects of it. If you just go in to handle just the spotted owl, for example, then, you know, and you're not looking at the impacts of what you're doing and how it's going to affect jobs in the area, how it's going to affect commerce and industry, how it's going to affect other wildlife, how it's going to affect the residents of the area, et cetera. You know, solutions that are too narrow in their focus and don't take into consideration the broader picture aren't usually going to end up lasting very long or being very effective. And so,
how do you make those kinds of decisions when perhaps you don't feel that you're an expert and you're hoping that that you can do the right thing or move in the right direction? But your viewpoint, you might not be able to see all of those permutations of the various topics. You might see the owl, but you don't see the other. Do you do nothing unless you can see everything?
No, I wouldn't. You know, I would never say do nothing. But I'll tell you, what I would say is look, go find out about those other things. You know, listen to if there's a controversial issue and, boy, you're really on one side of this thing because it really sounds right, but you haven't really looked for yourself. You've been just listening. Go look, you know, talk to people who have viewpoints on the other side and listen, really listen and see if there's something valid that they're talking about or that you know, with more data you might expand your horizon of, you know, or your view of what's going on. If you do enough looking, it's a very interesting fact that I apply in my life. If I'm puzzled or in mystery about something, it's because I don't have enough data, and I need to get more data. And so I go look for more data, whether I get online or I go talk to experts or, you know, call my mother-in-law or whoever, you know, just get more information about this. And and in the process of getting, you know, a lot of information about it, a real solution will usually become very obvious. It's an interesting thing because it's one of those things where, you know, we've all had that experience where you were really puzzling over something or worried about it and chewing on some bone of a problem and you know, gnawing away at it and unable to figure out a solution. And then all of a sudden, you get some new piece of information that comes in and all the puzzle pieces suddenly fall into place and you hit yourself on your forehead and go, oh, my God, of course, this is what we'll do. This will handle it. And you go do that and it handles it. And that when a person has done enough looking for themselves, that solution that makes sense, really makes sense, and that will really work, will fall out. But if a person just listens to, you know, just listens to the media or you know, just listens to one side of the viewpoint without really getting a full understanding of the whole scene, they can spend and waste an awful lot of resources on things that either, you know, and you see this all the time, solutions get introduced that just end up being the next problem you have to solve. And, you know, perfect example of that is the Gulf. In actual fact, rather than use the product that they used to sink the oil, it truly would have been better if they had done nothing. Because Mother Nature would have cleaned that situation up faster than what they did. But the apparency, you know, by sinking the oil was that was some sort of a solution. Now all those tar balls are just rolling up on the beaches and will continue to for years.
So these are lessons learned that hopefully will carry forward. And whether there was something nefarious in the initial reaction or just the best information that they had, it's organizations like yours that bring the best research forward and give the opportunity for those who are trying to make a difference to do the right thing the next time that there is a disaster.
Exactly.
We're winding down on time, and Barbara, I have to say it's always such a pleasure to have time with you and to learn from you and all the wonderful work that the Lawrence Anthony Earth Organization is doing. We've been with Barbara Wiseman here on the Nonprofit Coach Radio Show. As we wrap up the show here, Barbara, how can my listeners reach you?
You know, best way is through our website at www.theearthorganization.org. Don't forget the V. So T-H-E, earthorganization.org. And that's really the best way.
That's terrific. And a fantastic website that gives a broad view of all the work that you folks are doing around the world. And the release of that important paper is about 10 days away?
That's right. I'm very excited about it. This really is specifically for oil spill response decision makers, although we wrote it in as much layman's terms as we could so that we would have the broadest public possible for it. I think it's actually a fascinating paper. The title of it is A Call for a 21st Century Solution in Oil Spill Response. But it actually includes, a real solution to oil spill response that is cutting edge and that has, all the regulatory aspects in place that could be used immediately to clean up these oil spills.
That's terrific. Well, thank you again, Barbara Wiseman, for doing such a wonderful job around the world, for caring about the environment, and for being my guest here on the Nonprofit Coach, the Green Show.
Thanks, Ted, and thanks for the work that you do.
You've been listening to the Nonprofit Coach Radio Show with Ted Hart. Tell all your friends to check out our production schedule and download our iPod and iPad-friendly podcasts at tedhart.com. Thanks for listening to the Nonprofit Coach.